This is Lara, and I'm here with Alvin Bang, and we are in Edinburgh.
Edinburgh, nicely done.
At the Earl of Marchmont's pub.
Correct.
All right, and I'm just getting to, I mean, I know Alvin a little bit, but I'm getting to know him more. And
yeah, when was it we met? A couple of, it must be a few months ago now.
It was a few months ago, yeah. And it was at that, like, little basement, little place. It was like a white room.
It was like a white room. Oh, God, I'm trying to remember it. It was like,
it was this little afternoon stand-up comedy place. It was like a white cavernous.
Oh, yeah, it was. Was it, it might have been called, the show might have been Comedy at the Cavern, and I think, was it the Royal Scots Club?
Yes.
Is that where it was? Oh, very nice, yeah. That show's been discontinued in, like, about a couple of weeks ago, just before Fringe. Lee Brophy, who's a great comic, and he runs the show. Yeah. I messaged him to get on, and he told me the show's done.
That's too bad.
Yeah, it's too bad, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I think he had a lot of competition. There's another show called Old Cheeky. I don't have a horse in the race. They're both run by my friends. and to be fair, most people did both, but because Lee's show started earlier, then what would happen was all the comics would turn up, do Lee's show, and then everyone would leave to go to the next show because they had two spots. Which is, it's common here to do that.
Yeah.
But it's just obviously doesn't make for a great show when all your comics leave. So
Good. So when and why did you start doing comedy?
So I started performing stand-up comedy in, it was February of this year, because I got fired from my job. I was working for a company that I will not name. They're a Scottish comedy-centric television production company. If anyone is thinking of one, it's that one. There's one. And I was working for them, and they, I hated the job. It was like, so my background's in film. I have a degree in film, and I've made movies and stuff. I got fired from that job, which I hated anyway, because it was like an administration job.
Yeah.
And it's just maybe not for me or my boss. Also, I am in the process of being diagnosed with ADHD. And I did tell them this, but they didn't really care. And I just, it was a bit, I hated the job, and basically fired me for being shit at my job.
Wow.
And this is how you know they had contempt for me.
Yeah.
I had a contract, a temporary contract, and it was 1 month from the end, less than a month from the end, and they still fired me.
God.
And they gave me my 2 week notice and asked me not to work another day. They were like, we're giving you 2 weeks notice, but we'll just pay you. Can you just leave today?
Oh my God.
Doesn't that show you how much they hate me? But
why would they hate you?
Well, here's the thing. So it was only the boss, the big boss, whose name rings with Poozen. And the rest of them, I got on, especially the creative team, I got on really well with. And so I didn't have a creative job, but they had a radio sketch show. And I wrote some sketches for it just to submit to them. And they put one of them on. So I have one professional writing credit from that. And because at the same time, I was like meeting all, there's a comic that used to work for them, or maybe still does. He's called Stuart McPherson. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a Scottish stand-up, and he's really brilliant.
Yeah.
So I knew him, and I knew all these stand-ups. And they'd kind of all, I'd been talking about doing it and writing stuff. But I for some reason, the confidence thing, it just always really held me back.
Yeah.
And then when I got fired, and I had to give up my flat in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And I came back, my girlfriend lives in Edinburgh, so I came back to live with her. And I just was kind of trying to put back the pieces of my life because I didn't really know what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And then I just saw online that Monkey Barrel Comedy Club was like, we're doing a free-for-all next week. And I was like, I'm going to write, and whatever I've got at the end of the week, I'm going to get up and do it. And I don't know why, I think it came from a, part of it felt self-destructive. It's like, you know that, maybe this might be quite a Scottish thing, but over here when you're having, sometimes you have a very bad week and you go, I want to get really, really, can I swear on your podcast?
Yes. But,
okay, that's good, because I would struggle not to. I sometimes hear, you know, you have a bad week and go, I want to get really fucking drunk tonight. You know, it's like, it felt like that.
Yeah.
It felt like, I'm going to get up on that stage. And I think I talked about the workplace that fired me and stuff like that. And so that's, I've always wanted to do it, but that's what made me do it the first time.
Yeah.
And then I did it, and it, like, there's not a joke in the set I would tell now, but, you know, I just got off and I was like, oh shit, that was great. I can't wait till I get to do this again.
That's good.
So that is how I started stand-up comedy.
Wow. What got you into film then before that?
Well, like, I watched movies when I was a kid, but then when my dad, so when I would have been about 11 or 12, and I was just going into, started the summer when I was going into high school, what do you guys call that? It would have been middle school for you guys, I guess. Because you guys have like three schools or whatever.
We do, yeah.
So before I went to my first year of high school or middle school, my dad started showing me like all his favourite movies, and he always had a big DVD collection. I always like picked them out and watched movies, and some of that was probably like not too young for content-wise, because my parents were quite religious, so they didn't like that, but I would watch, you know, stuff that was like Ken Loach films and like stuff that was probably kind of like, you know, not above my, it wasn't really for me.
Yeah.
But my dad started over that summer, like just sitting me down and showing me movies. He showed me like One for the Cuckoo's Nest.
That's good, yeah.
Do you know the movie Ronin? It's like got Robert De Niro in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And like Heat. And like all the movies that were like his favourite movies of all time.
Yeah.
The Big Lebowski was one of them.
Yeah.
And these movies really changed in my head. Like, oh, how good can a movie be?
Oh, that's neat.
So it turns out the reason he was doing that is because he was about to leave. So,
Oh no.
That's what dads are for, right?
That's right.
And just to add, just for a little bit of flair for the narrative, and this is 100% true, my dad was at the time the pastor of a church. Like, we all went to the church, my dad was the pastor of the church.
Yeah.
And the way he left was by leaving my mum for a member of the congregation. But he thought he was going to still get to be the pastor. Because there's like, the way it works, we were a Pentecostal church. Which was actually, Pentecostal is probably bigger in America than it is here. It was very like, so we were very like, you know, Hillsong music and speaking in tongues, and like that was the kind of vibe of it.
Yeah.
And so there's a board, they're called Assemblies of God, and they like decide if you get to be
heard
a pastor
or
not. Yeah, I think they might be international.
Yeah.
And they obviously like, you're not, they stopped him being a pastor, like, you can't be a pastor if you do it. And he just didn't get it, he was like, what? What do you mean I can't be the pastor?
This
Well,
right.
Exactly. But then, and then because he left, I would go to see him like once a week, and that's pretty much what we do. We would watch movies.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I don't know, I growing up, I wanted to make movies. Then, I don't know, in Scotland, especially in the west of Scotland where I'm from, which is Glasgow, basically. If you're not from Scotland, then there's either the Highlands, Edinburgh, and Glasgow, the three ones. I'm from Glasgow out of those three.
Yeah.
And then, there's a very much a belief, like, people just don't believe in themselves here. It's very much part of our culture that.
Wait, Glasgow or Edinburgh?
Glasgow.
Oh, they don't believe
people in Edinburgh believe too much in themselves.
Oh.
People in Glasgow, people in Scotland in general, but especially in Glasgow, have this. It's very much, you know, if you don't express yourself, and if someone else does, you take them down a notch. So I remember I had a full time job when I left school. I had a full time job working sales, and then I got politically radicalised and became a socialist and didn't really want to do that anymore.
Yeah.
And I remember when I decided, you know, I'm going to go and try and make movies, I left and everyone was like, oh, mate. These were like 30-year-old guys and they were going, make films? Oh, you're going to make nothing, mate. You know, it was this, that,
yeah.
People were angry, they were trying.
You were like trying to move up.
Exactly, yeah, because of what you think you're better than us.
Yeah.
What, this isn't good enough for you?
Yeah.
And the answer was, well, no, it isn't to us. Like, this just doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
So then I went to college. I don't know how to, because we have college and we have university, and they're two different things.
Yeah.
So college is like, it's a lower level of qualification, and it's easier to get in, but it's generally more technical and less academic.
Right.
So I did 1 year of TV production, and then 4 years of a film degree.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I that's how I got into making movies.
Wow, that's cool. So now you've been doing it, what, 6 months?
Hope you have about 6 months now,
And stand right up. Now, is this the most intense time? Like what you're doing now? Like,
what you mean, Fringe?
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Actually, it's something I've been thinking about a lot, is to not wish it away, because when Fringe is done, there's going to be less gigs and less audience.
Yeah.
And the thing that I always, I'm joking about, like, to myself, is that I mostly perform gigs to other comedians and maybe one or two other friends.
Yeah.
And this Fringe, I realised the other day, I was like, oh, I've entertained people. Like, people came out for they wanted a night out, and I gave them that night out. And some of them enjoyed it, and gave me money because they enjoyed it. And I was like, oh shit, that was never part of it before. It was always, and I think it's hard to be a stand-up and not be a narcissist, probably, a little bit.
Yeah.
So for me, it was never about making people laugh. It was about, like, how do I get attention on me, basically. I like being up. I think especially when you're someone who, like, as my fatal flaw, I just love to talk, man. And I just can't resist the idea of, oh, you're going to get 5 minutes and everyone's chairs will be pointed at you, and you'll be higher than them, and you're going to have a microphone, and you're going to speak, and they're going to listen to you. And that's great. But most of the time, what humbles you from that is most of the time, it's 10 other comics looking at their notepad because they're about to go up. And so it's very easy to go. And before Fringe started, before, you know, I was going through a bit of a bit. I was like, oh, my material isn't good. No one cares about these gigs. And I was like, I'm not going to give up, but just, what's the point? Yeah. And then Fringe has really been good for me because it's like, this is the point.
This is good.
So yeah, this has definitely been the busiest point ever. And I've got like some, I don't know how it works. Like in your scene, the here is very much we get a good clip and send it to people and get booked for shows. But I now have a really good clip of me on a pretty professional stage, like kind of killing it. And I very rarely leave a gig going, I killed that. But there was, I had one gig in particular where I left and I was like, oh God, I killed that. And my girlfriend was there and I came off and she was like, that was, that just went so well.
That's good.
And I was sharing the bill with like this guy called, I'm not going to say his name, but he was an accordion based comedian. And he, do you know what, he was fun. He was very, what was cool about it was a cabaret show, but they had other comics on, and then one, like, he has this comic, but he's like very weird al. He had curly hair and a flower shirt and accordion, and he did an accordion cover of My Neck, My Back, My Pussy and My Crack. And it was, but to be fair, it, because of the kind of thing it is, it got everyone going. And then my act is, and a slightly, and I really mean like slightly alternative sometimes, because I, right now my first,
it's slightly what?
Alternative.
Okay.
Like in the, I'm quite inspired by like 80s British alternative comedy, and the first, about half
the
of my act
ones?
Is me, oh, I love the Young Ones, the Young Ones is so, so great. Yeah, Rick Mayo and stuff like that, I really love it. Actually, the Young Ones I only got into recently, and I love it so much. It's just, especially if you think about British stand-up comedy before that was effectively an overweight racist man with a pint of beer and a cigarette complaining about his wife and immigration. And then this whole idea of, hey, what about we do it, but we're not like that. And then, but then what's weird is now what was alternative comedy is the mainstream of comedy.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of an uprising now of very right-wing comedians. A comedian who I'm happy enough to name, his name is Leo Kearse. He's quite big in Scotland. And, woo! Real rough, that act is very much in the spirit of one of those old guys. And he's always complaining he can't get booked at clubs because everyone's so woke. And he can't get booked at clubs because people don't laugh at hate speech anymore. That's, right. Well, that's my opinion anyway.
Right. Yeah.
But that's a big thing now. Or I don't know if you saw, do you know Graham Linehan? He created three of the most iconic shows in British comedy history. Father Ted, which is, I probably shouldn't say British because it's an Irish show, and it's about people who work like basically Catholic priests, but it's really funny. It's you'll be hard pressed to find someone in Britain who doesn't love Father Ted. It's really brilliant.
Okay.
And then he made Black Books with Dylan Moran and Bill Bailey, which also people just adore. And then also he made The IT Crowd, which is how Richard Ayoade got famous. And his main thing now, though, he's an anti-trans rights activist. And he would say that he's not, but I just don't see how you can say he's not. He goes to anti-trans rallies, he makes speeches, everything. Yeah. He doesn't write comedy anymore. He does some stand-up stuff.
Right.
But the reason I mention this is last week he was supposed to perform in Leith Archers as part of a showcase. And when they found out he was going to be playing, they plugged the show, and it was a big debate in the stand-up community of like, is that okay? And so one side's argument is that you should let audiences decide, and that's censorship. And the other argument is we have to be responsible about who we platform, and that also individual venues should have the right to decide what they do and don't want there.
Right.
I happen to agree with the latter. I think you're not there's no obligation for you to have a stand-up set, and if you're allowed to go and become an anti-trans activist, you're allowed to do that if you want, but you're going to lose work over that, and that's just like, those are the consequences for that.
That's true.
So it's like, and it's not, people call it censorship. If he was being put in jail, or you're banned from the internet, I would be with you. That's censorship, but it's not censorship to not get a spot.
I
don't think that that's,
it's a free, like this is somebody's business or whatever.
And I feel like you as a business owner, surely you should be allowed to decide, nah, I don't agree with that, I don't want that at my, just the same way if Graham Linehan was running a comedy night, I don't suppose he'd have too many trans comedians on there.
Yeah.
And whatever, if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. But it's like,
that's tricky, because there was that, I don't know if you heard of the, there was a court case in America about a bakery.
Yeah, the gay. I remember it well. That must be a while ago, 10 years ago now or something.
No,
like that.
I don't think it was that long.
Oh, you think it was more recent than that? Yeah, I remember this well. It definitely was like.
And they were like, we're not going to make a cake with two women or two men on it, and then it went up to, I don't know, the Supreme Court, I guess, and then they supported them. They're like, no, you don't have to make
that's
that.
That's interesting. And to be fair,
but people are furious, and I feel like, I don't know. I think I see what you're saying actually now. I think that,
and I think it is hard. You know, there's it's not a right or a. I guess this is the hard thing, is that it's not. I don't think it's a right or a wrong. It's hard to figure that out. And,
yeah.
Well, I know a lot of gay people who's. I have a gay friend who says gay marriage should be legal, but you shouldn't. A church shouldn't be forced to have a gay marriage in their walls if they don't want to.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I don't have. It's hard for me to even. I just don't know about that kind of thing.
I know.
But I guess.
Why would you want to be married in a church anyway?
Well, yeah, that's
rejecting you. Like,
well, that's exactly. Well, that's kind of the thing. But then it's such a personal thing. Because like, I don't think I would get married anyway. Personally, it's just really not in my way my brain works. But I think it's so. At that point, then the surreality of the makeup of the world, because you're like, why is there a judicial element of marriage? That doesn't make sense. Why are the why is the law involved? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah.
So what are you? What is your goal with comedy? Is it just to make people laugh? Is it to make them think? Like, when you think of like long term, or do you even think about that? Are you just like
so in terms of what am I trying to get with the audience?
Like, what's your goal in life?
My goal in life, oh God. in the simplest terms, the main thing that I'm concerned about is that I cannot put into words how much I hate having a job. Like, I really can't. I want to do the things that I want. I want to just be left alone to do the things I want to do.
Yeah.
So I just want to make my stuff and have people see the stuff.
Yeah.
I don't like the idea, like, there's no, I like attention, but I don't want to be famous, so I like the attention of, I'm in the room and everyone's looking at me, and that's fun, but I don't want people to, like, necessarily know who I am. You get something out of, when I sit at home and I write something, and I think, oh, that's really clever, and I'm, because there's stuff, basically, I don't want to change how people think necessarily. I just want to say what I really want to say what I think, because I think so many things.
Yeah.
And I think it's a big part of being born and raised as like a white male, is all white males are just so convinced they have something to say. And I know that that's true, and I know it's true about me. Like, I always had a feeling of going, no, but what about what I've got to say? I really think I've got something special here. And I've realised that that's not true. But I also know I need an outlet for it somewhere, because I'm like, I can't just do that in life and conversations. But stand-up is literally what that's for. And the reason the medium works so well is it's one person, a microphone, and their thoughts. And it can be an observation, or it can be just something you've thought about in your head. And I find myself all the time, you know, I'm a million miles away, but I'm so deep in something and I'm laughing at it. And I love the idea of, oh, do we bottle that and, you know, put that in front of people? So.
So is it to make people think or to make them laugh, or both?
Both. I want to make people laugh and make people think, but I'm most, like, I want to entertain people enough for me to be able to get up and say what I want to say, and that involves saying what I think. And my job is to make it funny, because otherwise I've not done my job, but I just want other people to at least leave having kind of remembered the act, having laughed, and having remembered the act. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be... there's nothing worse than being mediocre, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that, like, terrible and amazing are much closer together than mediocre is.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the things that you... I learned this kind of writing films, but stuff that makes you cringe the most, that's when you're on the cusp of doing something great.
Yeah.
You know, I think those two things, it's a fine line between great and awful.
Yeah.
And you have, and if you're not risking it being awful, you'll never make something great.
It's true.
At least that's the way I think about it. I think is, if there's no chance it might be the worst thing ever, then it's probably not going to, it may be fine.
I saw a poster of a guy, I don't know what his show is called, Blowhole or something. And he's pulling his pants down.
Yeah. And I think it's great. But it's kind
it
of
got
awful.
My attention.
Well, like, and how hard is it to get people's attention?
I know.
But that's even, and this is a silly thing. I'm the only one in the open mic circuit that wears a suit.
Oh,
no one
wow.
else does it. Everyone gets up. Maybe their jeans and some people are wearing something, you know, that indicates the act. But I'm the only one who wears a suit. I'm the only one with a mohawk. And
I have to show you. Oh God, I can't. I'll show it to you after. But there's this guy who came to this open mic that we have in Squim, and he's actually from Denmark or Sweden or something, but he was born in America, and he just has showed up. He's only been doing stand-up, I don't know, 8 months or something, but he was wearing this suit. It was like from the 1920s. It was this very long, sleek suit, and I was like, everyone thought he was like, he looked like a grandfather, and I thought, did you just get dressed up for this? And then I know, like, he showed me his Instagram account, everything. He's always in like these very like stylish, classic suits.
Oh, nice.
And he looks like he's from, like, just the way he looks. He looks like he's, like, he doesn't have the punk look, which is a nice contrast, like punk with a suit. But he's more like, everything is kind of, like, that's his thing.
That's cool, you know, I like that. It was like, I don't know if you know the comic Tom Allen. He's, I am very, almost all of my stand-up comedy knowledge is, like, Britain-based.
Yeah.
And I think, basically, I think the American comics that are the best are generally not the ones that make it over here.
Yeah. Like,
most of the American comics that I know don't do it for me that much. It's just, it just doesn't speak to me.
Yeah.
Like, it just doesn't. So I'm very, very Britain-centric in my comedy.
Yeah.
But, which is not to say, my favourite comedian actually used to be Louis C.K., but we don't talk about him anymore.
I know.
actually, what annoys me is he gets, I talk to the, here's the thing, Edinburgh is very bro-y. And they
it's very what?
Bro-y. Lots of bros. Like,
what does that mean?
Like a, you know, like little, a bro, like a college bro. You know, like guys, like like douchey, basically.
Oh.
Like it's very like
frat.
Joe Rogan. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so, because I'm like, most of the young guys I know are more inspired by American comics. Like in Scotland, most of the young guys are more inspired by American style comedy.
Right.
That's becoming the new kind of thing here. Is bigger and kind of more American style comedy. And a lot of the guys are very, like, they all love Louis C.K., but they have no, every time I'm like, so I do think Louis C.K. is maybe the greatest comic to ever live, but he's a bad person. But you speak to these guys and they just have no, like, they just don't care about what he did. And they're you just see the special after and he just talks about it.
Right.
So that's the thing. But I guess I say that to not, I don't want to seem like the guy who's like, British comedy is great and American comedy is bad, because it's not true.
Yeah.
And there's loads of great, you know, Emo Phillips and there's loads of great Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
But I think there's the stuff that's big right now in American comedy that seems to sell just isn't my, it's not my language. It's not comedy's so subjective.
So what is it about you, the comics that you like? What do you like about the ones that you like?
Oh God, that's, and I probably don't even know. I'm trying to, so the comics that I love the most here, and they're all relatively, what's the word kids use now is basic, right? They're all relatively basic inspirations, but my favourite comic of all time is Stuart Lee, who is everyone in Britain's favourite comic of all time. Do you know Stuart Lee? Have you seen his work? I think I'll send you some of it. There's like stuff, he's got entire shows up on YouTube, and he came out of the alternative comedy scene of Britain in the UK, but he, his comedy is basically about comedy, and he kind of deconstructs what stand-up comedy is whilst he does it. And he's really good, like, really, the way he just spins webs around you, and he'll make a joke fail on purpose in a specific way, and then he'll do something afterwards, reveals that the whole thing was part of his plan. So I really love that, and that's what made me want to do it. And I don't do what he does, like, I'm not trying to deconstruct stand-up comedy, that's not my thing. But what he does is he talks about him, and another one of my favourites is Frankie Boyle. They talk about stuff that they care about.
Yeah.
Frankie Boyle has one of my favourite jokes ever written. I think this is one of the great jokes. He says that, if you think about Britain, we are one of the biggest arms dealers to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
But we're also the biggest provider in the world of aid to Yemen, which is currently wars being inflicted by the Saudis, who we're selling weapons to. And do you know why? Because if life gives you Yemen, you give Yemen aid. that's a joke that's really always stayed with me, because
that's
like, that is a set up punch. It's a pun, basically, about the military industrial complex.
That's true. Brilliant.
And I love stuff like that, because I didn't know those two things, and So both of those guys, basically the point I'm trying to get at is that both of those guys are, they talk about stuff that matters to them.
Yeah.
But it's not about getting you to leave. It's not about you leaving thinking, I agree with him. That's not what it's about. It's about you. Obviously, everyone wants everyone to agree with them, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's about, I want to say this because it's burning a hole in my brain.
Yes.
But I don't get to say it unless I make someone laugh. And plus, there's nothing, like, I've always been just like a politics bore and obsessed with that stuff. But there's a very specific joy in making that really funny, and not just kind of funny, you know, really funny.
Yeah.
So it's something about that, and then I think something about getting jokes, getting laughs that haven't been got before. You know, I don't like lazy humour, you know, where it's like, when you're in a conversation, people make sexual innuendos really freely. So you'll say, oh, that it's really hard, and someone's like,
I know.
And every time I'm like, really?
Yeah,
we're doing this, man.
Yeah,
no. But when it's something you've never thought about, you know those jokes where you go, fuck, I've never thought of that before. I love stuff like that, and I know that I've definitely never written anything like that. But as of recent, like, I do my first half of my act, and character's a right wing comedian, and it's my favourite bit to do.
Wait,
in the world.
You do it as what?
As a right wing comedian.
Oh.
I do the first, maybe the first 3 to 5 minutes as. And actually, I break character very briefly to explain that I'm doing that, because I found if I don't do that, I lose the audience. And it illustrates my point better, because the reason I wrote that bit is that I saw a comic do it, a stand-up set, and he did 5 minutes, and it went great. And then he did more, and it was really mean-spirited about him, like, telling his wife to go and put some makeup on, and he lost the room, and everyone started, it got awkward, and everyone was looking at each other going, it's a very intimate gig. And the guy went, oh, is it that fucking woke nowadays? And it really annoyed me, because I was like, how can't you see that you're the problem? Like, you're blaming us, but no one's laughing. And I went home and I wrote this whole bit, kind of in character as one of those guys. And what I found is, as long as I do it, I come out and I'm like, oh, you can't say anything anymore, man. And then what I do is I break it and I say, sorry guys, actually I used to be a left-wing comedian, but my shows have been going very good, and people find that really funny. And that was never supposed to be a joke. I wrote
good.
That to kind of get them to go,
that's good,
calm down, because I'm not, because the good thing is, people are rightfully going, is he going to say something bad?
Yeah.
And as long as I tell them that, I go, so I'm giving that a try, he's up for it, and everyone always goes, yeah,
that's
and
good.
Then I can just go for it, and I do a bit about, you've been transed. I thought that if you say the wrong thing, you've been transed, and it always seems to go, it always seems to go well. If I have a big enough room, then it goes well, because it splits the room, but that makes the people who like it love it, because they love
good.
That some people don't know.
Well, some people, it can be over their head.
It can be over their head, or they know I'm
too
making fun of them.
Like,
if you're a right wing, if you're actually right wing,
that's true.
Especially in Edinburgh, there's a lot of people who think like that.
Yeah.
So they hear that and they go, oh, okay, Mr. Smart Guy, you're making fun of me.
Yeah.
And I mean, I did it one time in the Cavern, and there was these two older gentlemen there, and they were in a very bad mood from the start. They didn't like any of us. And then I got up and I was like, I think I always do that, I find older men really like to be involved in it, so I always say, see, the older generation, people like you, and I'll point at a man, usually the best is if he's not that old, if he's in his 50s, because it's funny because you're calling them old, and I think they always like it, because they like being involved, they haven't the piss taken out of them, but these old men didn't like it at all. And I was talking about how they've been transed, and they just, because they clearly do think people get transed, but what it meant is, because they hated it so much, the rest of them loved it, because you're watching these old guys get so angry. I knew they were trying to heckle everyone and stuff like that, and it was really bad. And one guy came up and made a very good point, and he was like, just remember, every comic that you've ever loved has done gigs like this before, we're all trying to get better.
Yeah.
You know? But I don't even know why I'm talking about this right now, to be honest. I'm on such a tangent, but yeah.
No, just like the point of your comedy, what your goal is.
So yeah, I guess I like talking about stuff like that. A lot of my stuff is about, like, because I'm from a very working class background, and I'm from literally the most impoverished part of Scotland.
Wow.
I now live in Edinburgh, which is the richest part of Scotland.
Wow.
Then, and when I, so I'd never met a millionaire until I moved to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And then I had a friend group of 6 people, at least 3 of them, 3 confirmed millionaires, and I couldn't speak to the wealth of anyone else, but I know 3 of the people in my friend group were millionaires.
Wow.
Because Edinburgh's very rich, and film is a very privileged thing, even though uni is free in Scotland, because I don't know, apparently it's a human right or something, isn't that
yeah,
crazy?
Yeah.
But we, so yeah, when I came here, I met so many like super rich people. So a lot of my stuff is political from that standpoint, but I'm not actively going, oh, hey, let's talk about politics. I'm just saying, one of my bits is about the difference in like when I buy weed in Greenock and when I buy weed in Edinburgh. That's what it's like, it's stuff like that, but it is about class politics to me, and that's the point of me writing it. Because it, but you can do that as fun when you're kind of trying to get that in, and people don't realise that you're talking about the things that you care about, because they're just focusing on the story, and so all that stuff is cool.
Well, I think you have a lot of potential, and I think people, I mean, it's not always the case, but I think a lot of times people with really original thinking do come from like the working classes, and it's like you have lived experience and you have passion and you have care, and you know, and you care. And I think, I mean, I hate to generalize, but it seems like the more wealth people get,
yeah,
I mean, they've done studies on this. Not all wealthy people,
yeah,
but they, you can be disconnected. You know,
100%.
you're in this upper level, and if you don't deal with people below you who have less money than you, eventually you don't care.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know. And I think if you don't care, what are you? It's like when comedians, like whoever it is, once it doesn't. Some people like Chris Rock, I think, are always funny, but some of them, like, I can't remember his name. I've forgotten his name, but he's gotten so wealthy, he's not funny anymore.
Yeah,
like okay. He's just talking about stuff like nobody can relate to this stuff, you know. So
that's very true. There's a guy over here that so far hasn't. That's not been his problem, but I think it's going to be his ongoing problem. His name is Kevin Bridges. I don't know if you know him.
I've heard of him. Yeah,
and he's from Glasgow, a very poor part of Glasgow, very working class background. But that's why his comedy's great. So he's not like. If I'm excited with comedy, he's not the first guy I go to. But I do really like his stuff. I've seen everything he's done, and I've seen, I think, apart from his first two, I've seen every show he's ever done live.
Yeah.
And he's a stadium comic now. And I mean, he'll do, especially in Scotland, he's really big. So he'll do our biggest venue. And the biggest venue in Scotland is the Hydro in Glasgow. And he'll do 14 nights selling out the Hydro. Like, wow. Selling out 14 nights. That's how big it, because everyone from all over Scotland will come down to see and the guy's a millionaire now, but his whole thing is about being a working class guy. And so he had early stuff was about one of the routine that got him really big and his absolute gold is about comparing spring break in America to the Easter holidays, which is what we have.
Yeah.
And he does this whole thing about like Chad Hogan's party, and it's the idea of like an American party, and there's like, it's a big mansion, there's a band playing, everyone's got their red cups bobbing their head, and he does that and compares it to, instead of having a party, we have an empty, which is when your parents are out. And it's really good, because it's kind of, it's such a good way of looking at like, here's working class Scottish life. The one thing we always think is everyone's so shite here compared to the movies.
Yeah.
And so by comparing this idea of Chad Hogan's party in America to like what it's like in a Scottish, and all the things he says they're funny, but they're really true. You go, oh, I do know that guy.
I know.
There's a line about someone trying on everyone's jackets,
yeah.
And it's like, I've been in that party where someone's trying on everyone's jacket. Like, it's everything is so bang on. And I think because he's still very in touch with his roots, he's pals with the same people he was pals with back when he wasn't a millionaire. He can still write about that, because he writes now about, he does a bit and he's show a few years after about, it kind of takes that old routine, but now he's talking about what's happened at the empty 10 years on, and he compares that with, he's talking about American like songs where they're like, yeah, we're going to party till 6 in the morning, and he's like, over here a kicking out time of 6 in the morning, you'd be laughed out the room. And it's about how people are trying to escape their lives because they have kids and jobs to go back to. So that guy works really well because of that. But you're so right, and I think I'm always looking for it in his work to be like, you're going to trip up, because eventually you're going to run out of relatability. Because he can't do his act.
I know.
He just can't do his act without being the relatable kind of Scottish guy.
I know. It's going to seem fake eventually.
And he's done a great job. I think he's a good writer, and he's managed to. But probably each show isn't. The last show he did is my least favourite of the shows we've ever done. And it was really good, and I still laughed all the way through, and you know, there's different stuff. But yeah, his options are to either quit while he's ahead or adapt to a new writing style, because eventually. Here's this, even like, some people who grew up really rich, And the thing I realised when I came here was they just don't know what life's like for me. Like, I mean, people saying to me, can't your parents just give you money? And I was like, no. Yeah. Just end off. They have enough money for them just. Yeah. And then, so no, they can't. Yeah. Like, and that was the conversation I had to have with my mum when I was moving out. It was, okay, fine, but you're financially dependent. There's no,
yeah.
Like, it was, there's no, I'm behind on rent, can you pay it? If I'm behind on rent, then I quit uni and I come home and it's game over, so.
Yeah.
And because almost no one at university here, because even though in Scotland we have free university, there's still a huge class barrier, because it's an attitude thing, and people, working class people are encouraged to go to university, working class people are less likely to do well in school for so many different reasons, so I found that when I came here, little things like my girlfriend is very middle class, and we were out for dinner once, and the waiter took a bit long, I think forgot her drink, and she went, I'm not going to tip now. And I was like, well, here's why. That's not a good way to think.
Yeah.
And when I said it to her, immediately she was like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, but I was like, you just didn't grow up the same way I did. Yeah. Like, you, and you just see it in people all the time. That they, so I think you're right, and I think empathy is so essential to comedy.
It is.
It's so essential to comedy. It's why it's sometimes hard to laugh at stuff that feels really mean-spirited.
Yeah.
And it's why sometimes you hear a joke and you go, ooh. And even if it is funny, you really feel that. And that's part of the experience, but you need to be in tune with empathy, and if you're unempathetic, then I think it's hard to be fine.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I don't want to hold you up if you...
No, that's all right. I've probably got about 10 minutes before I need to get my taxi.
Okay. what else? What do you do when you're not doing comedy?
So,
how do you take? Do you think about other things like how, like, just your own like mental health and physical health, and like, do you think about just how to? Because I know, like, for me, like, just coming here, I immediately was like, I've got to like put up signs everywhere, and I got to do this, and I got to do that, and pretty soon I'm like just fried. I'm like exhausted, and I'm like, this isn't like, is this fun or is this just? Am I like getting caught up in some other kind of rat race? Like how do you have some awareness of that? Like, how to make sure you're taking care of yourself even as you're trying to do this thing that you're passionate about?
Yeah, and it is hard that way. Because I've always had a problem, you know, I've always just sucked at, I always feel like I've kind of sucked at life, you know, like I'm not good at having a job and turning up every day and stuff like that. So that's always been a little bit of a thing for me. I don't know, it's hard. It's a very good question. Comedy means a lot to me, and it's probably the only thing in my life right now where I feel like I'm getting some form of, like, not even satisfaction, not the right word, but like fulfillment. And when you feel unfulfilled, it's not good. When I was at my job, I didn't feel fulfilled because I was spending all my time working to make someone else rich, and I didn't do anything that I liked to do. So my relationship with that is better now, because back then I was working all day and then coming home and writing, just trying to write comedy as much as possible. I went on antidepressants when I was at my last job because I was depressed. But the thing I didn't like is I was like, I probably wouldn't have went on antidepressants if I didn't have to go to a job every day. But because I do and I'm not allowed an off day, then I need to find something that's going to make me go in every day. So actually it feels more like my problem isn't even like I need more structure in my day probably. So the more I go, I plan my day and structure things and go, I'm gonna write today and I'm gonna, you know, do this, this, this and this, and I have this gig tonight, so I'll be up at 9 so that I can like write and go through things. I actually find that probably helps me more because I have my life is generally in a state of chaos, and I kind of need to engage a very certain part of my brain that is hard to engage for me to go, let's sort everything out. Because when I care, I can be really thorough and hard working, but I kind of know life is a game of me making that part of me work, because I don't want to clean the kitchen, but I have to, so you've got to like make that part of your brain work, do you know what I mean? So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think the more I do comedy and stuff, that probably is me trying to take care of myself. I mean, if I know I'm not good, then I don't go to the gig. I'll just say, right now I don't really get paid for gigs. I got my first paid gig last night, so I'm lucky enough that I can just say, I'm not going to come to this open mic, I don't feel good.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I think the thing is, It's more like comedy is the outlet for, like, I think life is the thing that I struggle with. I think comedy is more of an outlet for that, because I'm like, at least now, it feels like nothing's on my terms ever.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. You know, it's like the most, it's what teenagers say, right? But you didn't ask to be born,
right.
And you certainly didn't ask to be born in for, like, I didn't ask to have to get a job.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, you have to go and get a job. And you're like, what? Like, that's the, I had no say in that. Why? Yeah. And people are like, oh, just because you've got to get a job. And, like, I've just never, that stuff is, I think some people just accept who things are. And I just don't. I don't, and because I don't. And people who accept how things are probably are slightly happier. At least in that they're like, oh, yeah, this is just how it's going to be. So comedy is more of an outlet for that, because I'm like, the world is fucking insane and it makes sense when I'm doing this. There seems to be something to make sense, because other people are doing it, people are coming, and I feel good when I leave after, and it gives me something. If I'm thinking it and I've got gigs, it gives me something to, if I don't have something to, I don't like having places to be, but if I have nowhere to be, then it's hard to feel like anything exists.
Right.
Do you know,
right.
Does that make sense? Yeah, like, it just feels like, what's the point in anything? And I'm just drifting from day to day.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, I went through, because I'm unemployed, but then I work freelance in film, so I do work. And then it's been really quiet recently. And at first, during the quiet period, I was just like, my life was a disaster, because I didn't know where to be, and I was just like sleeping in and doing nothing. And it's hard, because I think we're conditioned to not be self-sufficient, so that we can be handed a schedule by school and then an employer.
I know.
So that you follow that.
Yeah.
And when people say, oh, I wouldn't know what to do if I just had free time, that's the system working, I think. So I need to go, no, this is what I'll do with my free time. And then the more I do that and kind of work towards doing comedy and stuff like that, things seem to make more sense and it seems to be better for me. But I'm also lucky, like, I live with my girlfriend and my best friend, so I have loads of social time and I see people all the time and stuff like that, so that stuff is a part of my life. I probably feel like I indulge too much in the stuff that I like doing, and I should do more, I should work harder probably.
So my last question then is, how do you balance things that you really love, like comedy, with other people? Like, because as an artist, I always feel like if I really did what I wanted to do right now, I'd be living in a place like this. I would be not doing my job anymore. I would just be people watching and writing and performing. That's what I would do. But I have a family. I have kids. They would be living far away. I would miss them. I feel duties. I feel obligations. I feel like I got to pay bills. But how do you... I mean, you're young. And I'm 54, so we're at two different places, but still, like, how do you balance things that you're passionate about that give you meaning with, like, other people, like your girlfriend or your best, like they have certain needs of you too, so how do you...
And that's definitely a thing for me, because I know, like, I think I'm just at my core quite a selfish person, and I'm all, my instinct is always just to do the thing that I want to do, you know. I know some people, like my girlfriend, will always give up what she wants to do, you know, to make you happy. That's kind of her tendency, you know. So she kind of is trying to learn to probably be a bit more selfish. I have the opposite problem, but I think I'm quite good at going. There's times where I'm like, I want to do this show, and then I'm like, no, I can't do this show. I'm gonna stay. I told Niamh I would stay in with her and do this, and it's always gonna be a thing in my head, because I'm going, oh, other people are gonna do the show, am I gonna be forgotten about?
Yeah.
But then the other thing is, so I started comedy after I was with Niamh.
Yeah.
And so Niamh is like, I do have a certain loyalty to Niamh. So, I mean, I guess it's just a lot of, it's a little part of growing up as well. I think I'm 24, so I'm probably better. If I'd started when I was 18, I'd have been blowing off my girlfriend at the time and, like, not seeing my friends or whatever. All of that's probably a thing. The other thing is, me, Niamh, and Ethan, that's my girlfriend and my flatmate, we have quite an arrangement in that we're, like, we've lived together for a long enough time that it would be very hard for any of us to live with someone else, and it'd be very hard for someone else to live with any one of us. Because we just have, it's very warts and all with us in a way that's great, and it really, really works for the friendship in it. So that helps, in that we can afford to be quite kind of like, I'm going to be absent for this week and then kind of be back or whatever. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's just a matter of, I have to pull back something and think about what really matters and what. For me, the number one thing before I had comedy and making films and stuff, the number one thing that I always knew made me happy was, like, spending time with my friends, it's when I feel the most present, is when things, when you have the most fun and stuff like that. So that's always been a priority for me. And then I don't, I'm definitely like the black sheep of my family, and like I love my family, it's not that I have a bad relationship, but I'm just, I've never been, they're on one wavelength and I'm on another. It's always been like that. So my friends have always meant a lot to me for that reason, because they've always been on my wavelength. So, and then when you're at when you live at home, the people you're friends with are still kind of just the people that live near where you live near. Whereas when I came to Edinburgh, it's like people have come there for the same purpose that you've come there. And so,
so I have your friend and your girlfriend all moved here?
Yeah, so my girlfriend's from Belfast in Northern Ireland, and my flatmate's from Dundee, which is in the east of Scotland. Okay. That would come under Edinburgh to you guys, but it's actually very far away. Yeah.
But they moved here at the same time you moved here?
For, we all met through uni.
Oh,
we all studied together.
Okay.
So yeah, that's kind of how, that's how the whole thing kind of came to be. And yeah, me and we all lived together before I was going out with Niamh. We lived together and she had boyfriends and stuff like that. And the relationship kind of just started like through us living together and stuff like that. It kind of just happened. And then we lived separately and stuff like that. But now we all live together because I got made homeless and they took me in and stuff like that, which I'm very, very grateful for. So I've always kind of had a lot of loyalty to them, and I think I always will have time for them. But it's hard sometimes when I'm like, I want to do as many shows as I can this week, and I have to, it's like they don't, no one schedules time for you and like your partner to spend time together, so unless you do it. So that's a thing as well, 100%. And I always feel an obligation to things. I'm always like, oh, this is such an obligation. But yeah, I don't know, it's just part of me. Like, I just have to let myself be in a huff about things for 10 minutes and then go, okay, grow up, and other people exist too.
Well, thank you very much, Al.
No, thank you very much for having me, Lara.
It's been great.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been great fun.
I get to pick your brain.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's been absolutely fantastic. Are you excited about the rest of your Fringe run?
I am. I'm going to say goodbye here to the Average Joe Talk Show people. Thank you. Adios.